More than 2,300 people, most of them women and children, have been killed and nearly 10,000 wounded in Israel's onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip. Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh says Israel's plot to evacuate the people of Gaza is doomed to fail as Palestinians will not leave their homeland. Iran has warned that the continuation of Israeli crimes against Palestinians will change the situation in the entire region. Good to have you with us. The Israeli regime keeps pounding the densely populated Gaza Strip relentlessly for the eighth day in a row, killing civilians and reducing buildings in the besieged Palestinian territory to rubble. One of the latest strikes, the regime killed 27 Palestinians in Jabalia, north of Gaza. Some 2,300 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 10,000 wounded. Over 700 children are among the dead. At least 15 hospitals have been damaged by Israeli shelling and air raids. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says at least 21 Israelis and foreigners held by the group were also killed in airstrikes. The attacks began last Saturday. More than 420,000 people in Gaza have been displaced since then. It's more than a million now. And more than a million Palestinians in northern Gaza facing an Israeli deadline on Saturday to flee to south. The territory remains under Israel's complete siege with no access to electricity, water, food, and medicine. Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh has accused Israel of committing war crimes and preventing humanitarian aid from entering Gaza. Now, Sderot is an Israeli settlement close to the Gaza Strip. It's one of the places where fighters with the resistance movement Hamas infiltrated last week during Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Nahal Alam Press Corps has been touring that settlement.
We are here in the Sderot settlement near the besieged Gaza Strip, which has been subjected to heavy Israeli strikes. Now, of course, many of the settlers have left this area after it was targeted by a barrage of rockets. Lots of material damage here, including to cars and buildings, and it happened at a time when there were a lot of settlers here. Sderot was hit by lots of rockets and missiles, and resistance fighters were present here when they started their Al-Aqsa flood operation. After heavy fighting, the Israeli army took back control of this area. A settlement that was once housing many settlers has now turned into a deserted town thanks to the rockets fired by resistance forces. There are now only military forces here. Still, rockets and missiles are being fired toward this area, rockets that are in response to the Israeli regime's crimes against Gaza. This place is located in the so-called Gaza Envelope, which has been declared as a closed military zone by the Israeli army. Huge numbers of forces and armored vehicles have been dispatched to this area by the regime, which has called up more than 300,000 of its reservists. The Gaza Envelope is still being targeted by rockets and missiles fired by resistance forces. There's also been sporadic fighting in this area, which demonstrates that the regime still does not have full control over all places in the Gaza Envelope. The Israeli army is still trying to once again bring it back under its full control, while regime intelligence forces have declared it a danger zone.
Now, as part of its Operation Al-Aqsa flood against Israel, Hamas has fired thousands of missiles into the occupied territories. The Palestinian resistance movement has performed the farthest launch since its military campaign began on Saturday. The Palestinians say that Ayash 250 was fired at Israel's northern command base in the city of Safed. Israeli media claims it was intercepted by the regime's missile systems. Sirens were sounded all the way from settlements close to the Gaza Strip to cities such as Haifa. The missile has a range of 250 kilometers. Hamas previously stated that it could target anywhere in the Israeli-occupied territories. So far, more than 1,500 Israelis have been killed and 3,400 injured in Operation Al-Aqsa Flood by the resistance group. Hamas says it launched a military campaign in response to repeated Israeli desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and crimes and aggression throughout the decades. The head of the Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, says the Palestinian people will never leave their land despite the recent Israeli bloodshed in the besieged Gaza Strip. Haniyeh says the Palestinians have a country and their country is Palestine. Hamas officials said that the people of Palestine will not emigrate from their land, despite the Israeli regime's barbaric crimes to eliminate the roots of Palestinian people. And he added that the return of Palestinian people to their ancestral land is close, given that the regime's plan that's assisted by the U.S. is doomed to fail. He praised the military wing of Hamas, the Al-Qassam Brigades, for performing the operation against the Israeli regime. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it's targeted an Israeli military base in the border village of Shtula. In a statement, Hezbollah said it had struck the site with guided missiles, causing casualties. The attack came in response to Israeli attacks on journalists and other Lebanese civilians. The Israeli military confirmed that one of its positions was hit. It said the missile fire from Lebanon killed one person and wounded several others. The regime added that it responded by targeting Hezbollah's positions. Not rallies going on, slamming the Israeli onslaught in Gaza. Tunisian capital, Tunis. We had a big rally also elsewhere, Morocco, in Europe. We had Copenhagen early in the day. We had London, Paris, Istanbul, different parts of the world. In different parts of Europe, some of the rallies have been held, and some of them are ongoing, like one of them in Brussels. And we have our correspondent on the phone. Jerome Hughes is on the phone with me. Jerome, where are you and what's going on?
Close to the city center here in Brussels, and you might remember last Wednesday, a short distance from here, a couple of kilometers, there was a huge protest outside the Department of Foreign Affairs. Well, this time, the protest has moved to a different area of the city, but once again, we have thousands of people on the streets who are campaigning for change, who are campaigning against the United States and the European Union, for on one hand saying that Israel cannot commit international war crimes, cannot break international law, humanitarian law, but at the same time sending weapons to Israel and not doing anything to either stop the blockade or to prevent this pressure and this mass movement of people from northern Gaza down to the south of Gaza with no exit, no humanitarian aid, etc. And the people here, it has to be said, are furious. You are seeing people here who have traveled from across Belgium and beyond, even France, the Netherlands, and Germany. And we've been speaking to them here for the last hour or so. And there's this growing resentment against this hypocrisy. People keep, when I'm interviewing them, they're talking about the hypocrisy that on one hand, you have Anthony Blinken, for example, from the U.S. doing a tour of the Middle East, and he's talking about, you know, the Israel cannot break international law, while at the same time, the people here are saying that the United States is complicit, is helping Israel to break international law, and people are furious. And then you have a situation whereby EU leaders, Charles Michel, the head of the European Council, announced on Saturday that there will be an emergency meeting of EU leaders via video conference on Tuesday evening. And then you have people on social media, and even people I've been speaking to here, saying this is absolutely ridiculous. If they think it's a crisis, if they think it's an emergency, hold an emergency meeting straight away. Don't wait until Tuesday evening. I mean, it's now Sunday, and they're waiting until Tuesday evening. So there's a lot of frustration here, but there's a lot of anger as well, because they see that there is a great deal of hypocrisy. The feeling here is that the Western leaders are waiting for what they're calling it here is genocide, ethnic cleansing. The EU leaders are waiting for this to take place before they hold some talks. And you had Ursula von der Leyen, who's the head of the European Commission, under enormous pressure, announced that they're tripling the humanitarian aid to Gaza. But this was after a week, more than a week, of actually only taking sides with Israel and only talking about the need to support Israel, and they're 100% beside Israel. And then finally she made an announcement that there would be an increase of humanitarian aid. But the point is, it's an absolute misnomer. It's a paradox. It's nonsensical, because how can you triple the aid, the humanitarian aid to Gaza, for example, when you cannot get the aid into Gaza. What's happening, of course, if you listen to what the people here are telling me, is that there is ethnic cleansing, that the people are being pushed away from their homes are being destroyed, children are dying, and you have hospitals being bombed, etc., and there are so many people that cannot move within Gaza. So the idea that the EU is saying that it's going to triple the aid, well, when will this aid arrive, how will it arrive, and so on. So people here, there's no doubt about it, they're furious.
Right, and we now have Brussels, really huge crowds of people out there waving Palestinian flags and chanting slogans. A while ago, we're talking about, you know, people held rallies against dispatching all these, you know, armaments and ammunition to Ukraine to continue the fight with Russia, because people said, we at home, on home turf, we have our own issues, and they didn't want the European governments and authorities to rush to help Ukraine. Now, Palestine is on spotlight, as we know, in the past 8-9 days. And I think this is a much bigger rally compared to the previous ones that you have been reporting for us.
Well, Behrouz, the rallies are getting bigger. I mean, the one we had on Wednesday was very huge as well. It's very hard to say exact numbers, but it's easier to see the larger number of people at this particular rally that we're at today, this demonstration. So, you know, the last one was huge. This one is equally huge, or maybe bigger. And it's difficult to put exact numbers. But, you know, there's a very cross-section of society here. I've been speaking to Jewish people. They come out in large numbers to support the Palestinians. So this is not about religion. I've been looking at a lot of signs that people are holding up, and they're saying it's got nothing to do with religion. It's got nothing to do with, you know, anti-Semitism or against Jewish people. This has got to do with basic humanitarian, basically human, ordinary civilians being killed. The death toll is rising by the minute in Gaza. And again, you have people from all walks of life here, and they're saying enough is enough. And so I think there will be more rallies here in the coming days. It has to be said that there was from what I could see, there was a greater police presence at the previous rally, but no doubt you can be sure that there are water cannons standing by. You can be sure of that nearby here, and police as well, in case things get a little bit messy. But you know that invariably that doesn't happen. The 99.9% of the people at these rallies are actually want peace. They're not interested in any sort of violence. And so that's not an issue. But what you do have is, in Western governments, you see it in the United Kingdom, you see it across the big countries of the European Union, Italy and France, Germany, and here in Belgium, and in the United States, that what they're trying to do is more or less close down these protests. But I think what's happening this time, Behrouz, is that with the advent of so many different social media platforms and alternative media, the world is really being informed like never before. And so this time it does feel different, but that doesn't really help the millions of Palestinians who are in Gaza, for example. So, you know, while at the same time it's great from the movement's point of view in terms of trying to bring about positive change, really, it doesn't really help the people on the ground as we speak. And that's why it's so devastating. I was speaking to one young man here who has, he said his brother was killed in Gaza yesterday. He had cousins killed in Gaza a couple of days ago. And they're in tears. They're devastated. They just cannot believe that the Western world is standing by and is not only not preventing these atrocities, but is actually doing nothing to prevent not only doing nothing to prevent these atrocities, but it's actually facilitating it by way of giving unending support to Israel, sending aircraft carriers in the case of the United States for the reason, and supplying Israel with weapons, and all the time saying that Israel has a right to defend itself. Well, I mean, nobody in their right mind. You would have to be living on a different planet to think that what's happening in Gaza, for example, it has anything to do with Israel defending itself. And that's why frustration is so high here. people are very emotional. Either they're crying or they're angry, but the emotions are very, very high, and they're promising to hold more protests in the future. And as I mentioned earlier, when you have the EU leaders meeting by video conference on a Tuesday evening, a couple of days from now, people are asking, well, if they really think that the Gaza is facing a crisis, then why don't they do something more immediate? Instead of that, they're waiting for things to transpire in Gaza. But also, you have a situation, look at Charles Michel. He sends out an invitation letter to the EU leaders, and that's also sent to the media, those who are accredited like myself. And in the invitation letter to the EU leaders relating to this emergency summit, he talks about, you know, this has a potential major complication for the European Union. And he's talking in that context, in the letter he mentioned, migration flows, the potential for migration flows. Well, they're not talking about migration, because we're talking here about refugees. When you have an entire region with over 2 million people being bombed, you're talking about refugees. So once again, it's a situation where we've seen it in other parts of the region, in other parts of the world. We've seen it in Africa, we've seen it in Afghanistan, Iraq, we've seen it in Syria, we've seen it in many other places, whereby the United States and the European Union countries, they facilitate this mass displacement of people, if you want to call it that way. Mm-hmm. And now they're worried about refugee flows. So actually, a big paragraph in his letter was about migration flows. So it seems that they're more concerned about the potential refugee crisis that could come from this, when in fact, if you look at the details, they've helped to facilitate these refugee flows by ignoring the needs of the Palestinians, ignoring the right. needs of the people of Gaza and the West Bank for decades, and actually and suddenly things spill over, and now suddenly they're worried about a refugee crisis.
Yeah, okay, Jerome, thank you so much for that. We'll get back to you at another time. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent for us in Brussels. Now let's go on with our a news broadcast. Iranian foreign minister warning that the situation in the region will not remain the same if the Israeli regime's crimes against Palestinians continue. Hossein Abdullahian says that Tehran will continue its efforts to stop the Israeli war crimes and will never fall short of its principles in supporting Palestine. He made a comment in a meeting with a Hamas leader in Qatar. Ismail Haniyeh, for his part, said that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood dealt a strategic blow to Israeli regime, and the war crimes in Gaza show their confusion. Amir Abdullahian also met with his Qatari counterpart earlier, stressing the need for ending the siege of the Gaza Strip and withholding food, water, and electricity. He's engaged on a diplomatic tour of West Asian countries, focusing on Israeli strikes on Gaza. Amir Abdullahian has already visited Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, and he's met with high-ranking officials in those countries. All right, with that, we come to the end of this newscast from Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Trump Organization executives considered adding $144 million to Donald Trump's net worth based on a premium for presidential property in 2017. According to evidence presented during Trump's civil trial in New York, we take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. After journalists revealed several years ago that former President Donald Trump was likely not as wealthy as he claimed, executives at his company scrambled to justify new allegedly inflated valuations, volleying around ideas like applying a premium for presidential property to certain assets, according to evidence presented during Trump's civil trial in New York. The internal deliberations began after Forbes magazine revealed in 2017 that Donald Trump's Manhattan triplex, or three-story apartment, was about a third of the size he had long claimed, about 11,000 square feet instead of the 30,000 square feet that he had claimed, and thus was far less valuable. When Trump began reflecting the true size of the property on financial statements, its value dropped by as much as $207 million, according to a 26th of September ruling in the case that found Trump and others liable for fraud. A trial on allegations related to the ruling is ongoing. Alan Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, testified on Tuesday that the difference was a proverbial drop in the bucket compared to Trump's net worth, claiming that when you look at the value of that apartment relative to his net worth, it is non-material. But in late 2017, Alan Weisselberg was particularly interested in unique ideas for finding extra value for Donald Trump properties, according to a testimony on Friday, 13th of October, from another Trump Organization executive. The executive, company vice president Patrick Burney, was shown a spreadsheet compiled that year in which the company proposed assessing a premium for presidential properties, calculating a series of re-evaluations. 15% of premium for presidential winter residence, read one line under Mar-a-Lago. Another line for Trump's Bedminster Golf Club read 15% premium for presidential summer residence. The line for the triplex listed 25% premium for presidential personal residence. Also, the nine new valuations would have added more than $144 million to Donald Trump's estimated wealth. Ultimately, though, the idea was scrapped. But the episode is core to a case in which the state of New York is trying to claw back at least $250 million in what it calls ill-gotten gains. The state's argument works like this. Donald Trump, two of his children, and his company lied about how much properties were worth and how much Trump was worth in order to get favorable loan rates and insurance deals. By doing so, the state's argument goes, they benefited to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. And New York Attorney General Letitia James claimed in her 2022 lawsuit those high valuations were also personally important to Donald Trump. This public desire to inflate his net worth was well known amongst his children and employees. Letitia James' office wrote in its complaint, highlighting internal emails and deliberations about publications that assess and rank society's wealthiest. Alan Weisselberg acknowledged during his Tuesday testimony another directive he gave to former Trump Organization controller Jeffrey McConney. That was intended to boost the value of certain golf properties. Simply say they are worth 30% more. That 30% premium was not disclosed in Trump's statements of financial conditions given to banks. On Wednesday, 11th of October, the court held testimony from a former Deutsche Bank executive who was involved in assessing loans to Donald Trump. He testified that the golf courses were unusual collateral for a loan that he didn't know had value, since the potential buyer's market for golf courses is particularly small. Still, he testified, I assumed that the representations of the value of the assets and liabilities were broadly accurate. Alan Weisselberg and Jeffrey McConney are also defendants in this case. Attorneys for the defense have argued in court filings that the company was within its rights to add so-called brand premiums to its valuations. On Friday, 13th of October, Bernie testified about another moment in 2018 when the public's understanding of Donald Trump's wealth sent company executives scrambling. A Bloomberg reporter emailed Weisselberg and two other executives about its billionaires index. The company was prepared to slightly reduce its estimate of Donald Trump's wealth from $2.9 billion to $2.8 billion. The executive assigned Bernie to research data that might combat Bloomberg's analysis. Bernie fired off a series of emails to the company's bankers and others. Some, he said, may have been dictated to him by Alan Weisselberg, seeking information relating to the values of various properties. The matter, Bernie wrote, was urgent. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Trump Organization executive Patrick Bernie was once pressured by his former chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg to use an unrealistic metric to inflate the value of the Trump Tower. Bernie testified to a court of law. Patrick Bernie testified that he consulted a generic real estate report to determine a 2.67% capitalization rate to measure the value of Trump Tower. Despite an executive at real estate company Cushman & Wakefield recommending a higher rate, which would have decreased Trump Tower's value. When Alan Weisselberg and Patrick Bernie discussed the topic in a Trump Tower restroom, Patrick Bernie said he encouraged the chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, to use a higher, more realistic capitalization rate that would be more sustainable in order to maintain the building's value in the future, Bernie testified to the court of law. I think he said just use 2.67%, Bernie recalled. I said I'm fine using that capitalization rate, but I'm worried that if we're only using 2.67%, the building is so old, next year, there might not be a cap rate as low as 2.67. The New York Attorney General, Letitia James, alleges that Weisselberg systematically rejected multiple valuations of Trump Tower in 2019 that would have lowered its value between $161 and $224 million. Also, Trump Organization executives considered adding $144 million to Trump's net worth based on a premium for presidential property in 2017, according to testimony of executive member Patrick Bernie. The premium, which was applied to draft versions of Trump's financial statements, varied between 15% and 35% for various Trump properties, including his Mar-a-Lago club in Florida, which was described in documents as the presidential winter residence, according to materials entered into evidence. The potential adjustment followed a $200 million shortfall between Trump's 2016 and 2017 statements, after a Forbes magazine article prompted executives to revalue the former president's penthouse, state attorney said. Who directed you? State Attorney Eric Haran asked Patrick Bernie about adding the premium. I don't really remember, but probably it was Alan Weisselberg, Patrick Bernie replied. Bernie testified that the premium was eventually removed from the 2017 statement according to a document that tracked changes made to the statement. He did not provide additional context about why the premium was removed.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran. And we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were having a look at different verses of the Holy Quran that mention why people should engage in supplication and remembrance of the Almighty Allah. We were mentioning different benefits and different effects for supplication, the third of which was the fact that it actually is the belief in the Almighty Allah. We said that since all the human beings, both internally and externally, are filled with needs that they have to satisfy, so they always are in need of assistance. They are in need of constant, actually, attention and assistance. And if they find out that they have this Lord who is the absolute cause, who is the creator of this world, this is the time. This is the chance for them to be engaged in supplication and remembrance of the Almighty Allah. So, different verses of the Holy Quran recommend, highly recommend, engaging in supplication and in remembrance of the Almighty Allah. So, among those is this verse, وَمَنْ أَعْرَضَ عَنْ ذِكْرِي فَإِنَّ لَهُ مَعِيشَةً ضَنْكَ. And whoever turns away from my reminder, his shall be a straitened life. وَنَحْشُرُهُ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ أَعْمَى. And we will raise him on the day of resurrection blind. This means, dear listeners, that the one who does not remember the Almighty Allah, the one who is actually misled, the one who is diverted from the path of remembrance of the Almighty Allah, he will experience this strained life. He will experience this kind of stress. He is the one who will not find anywhere to satisfy his needs. He is the one who cannot find anywhere for his heart to be at rest. He and such is the one who will never stop yearning. He will always yearn for everything. And such man who will not be saturated, he will not be satisfied ever. That's why, concerning the hypocrites, God says, لَا يَذْكُرُونَ اللَّهَ إِلَّا قَلِيلًا. And as a result, for the infidels, God says, الَّذِينَ كَانَتْ أَعْيُنُهُمْ فِي غِطَاءٍ عَنْ ذِكْرِي. Their eyes were under cover from my reminder. This means, exactly as this part of this verse today says, نَحْشُرُهُ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ أَعْمَى. This being blind on the day of resurrection means they cannot see. Possibly they cannot see the path of salvation. They cannot see the right path. And what could be worse than this? Being blind in the journey, you need to be aware of all the dangers and hazards around you. This is the worst kind of cruelty to yourself.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javob onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad abaz bala bakas. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah. God let me hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through. Knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable. Knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So, in the Holy Quran, there are many advantages mentioned for supplication. For instance, it says, الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَتَطْمَئِنُّ قُلُوبُهُمْ بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ أَلَا بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ تَطْمَئِنُّ الْقُلُوبُ. Those who believe and whose hearts are set at rest by the remembrance of Allah, surely by Allah's remembrance, أَلَا بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ تَطْمَئِنُّ الْقُلُوبُ, are the hearts set at rest. And definitely, as we mentioned, much engagement in supplication, frequent engagement in remembrance of the Almighty Allah, it needs full recognition. It needs knowledge. That's why in the verse we discussed so far, it was said, وَذْكُرُوا اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا لَعَلَّكُمْ تُفْلِحُونَ. Remember Allah much, that you may be successful. The word falah, this salvation and progress, indicates progress in the divine and spiritual perfection, in this path. And this invitation gives a positive response to the servant's prayers, and it responds to the most of their logical needs and requirements. And this means that men who are under constant pressure to satisfy their needs are having this advantage. They are familiar with the Creator. He is the one who can assist them, and they are the ones who have found this assistance. They are the ones To be better said, they are the ones who have found this as their only assistance. And God is the one who has given them this asset, this special asset is given for only those who are special servants. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry, and that's when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of innocent children from Gaza will be ignored, buried, and replaced by the Western propaganda narrative perpetuated by the Zionist settler colonial regime. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Biden administration is supporting massacres from the sky by the Israeli apartheid regime. It's a serious charge rooted in facts. The U.S. is rearming the fabricated regime of Israel, even as hundreds of Palestinian children are being killed by Israel's airstrikes. The truth is, brown and Muslim people have always counted for less in the eyes of European and American regimes. The ongoing and constant Israeli regime bombardment in Gaza has claimed the lives and bodies of thousands of innocent people in just the past days. The occupying power has made it nearly impossible for rescue teams and ambulances to access areas that have been destroyed. The intense bombardment has rendered roads impassable. There is also an acute shortage of fuel for emergency vehicles. This human toll is accompanied by an unprecedented level of destruction to civilian, commercial, and residential areas to fulfill Israeli regime politicians' promise to burn the besieged, occupied, and embattled Gaza Strip to the ground and either return it to the Stone Age, as Benny Gantz once bragged, or destroy it completely, as Likud's M.K. Tali Gottlieb has just called for." Hundreds of innocent children from Gaza will be ignored, buried, and replaced by the propaganda narrative perpetuated by the Zionist settler colonial regime. These current massacres and violent policies are not a new phenomenon. It is this historical violence that rendered some 75% of Gaza as refugees, forcibly displaced within their land. It is this history that Western media refuse to mention. We, they seem to think are just angry people with no just cause. What the Biden administration fails to comprehend is that Palestinians are no different from any colonized people fighting to defend their land, their right to live in dignity and freedom, and their entitlement to full humanity. These have been systematically denied us by an apartheid regime that seeks to dehumanize, dispossess Palestinians from their land, and erase them from world consciousness. Gaza dead children are nothing to them, at best eliciting crocodile tears as they blame the Palestinian resistance for making them slaughter friends, neighbors, and cousins from thousands of feet above the open-air prison that is Gaza. Crescent International, meanwhile, wrote, the Zionists are using U.S.-supplied F-15 and F-16 planes to bomb the tiny Gaza Strip and destroy its infrastructure. It is also using phosphorus bombs that are banned under international law against the Palestinian people. It has frequently bombed Gaza since 2008, after the Zionist invaders were driven out of the tiny enclave in 2005. The Zionist regime attacked Gaza in 2008, 2009, 2012, 2014, 2018, 2020, 2021, 2022, and again in 2023. If the Zionist regime war criminals believe they can terrorize the Palestinian people into submission, they must be the most stupid people in the world. What did the Zionists achieve in their previous wars on Gaza? They destroyed much of Gaza's infrastructure and killed thousands of innocent Palestinians. Did that force the Palestinians to surrender? Absolutely not. In the Zionist regime's latest murderous bombing campaign, many civilians in Gaza have been killed, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. At least 60% are women and children. This number will certainly rise as the Zionists continue to bomb the besieged enclave. Electricity, water, fuel, and food have also been cut off to the 2.2 million inhabitants. This constitutes a war crime, according to the UN Special Rapporteur for Palestine. The fabricated regime of Israel is a terrorist regime. It is backed by such other terrorists as Joe Biden, Rishi Sunak, and a host of other war criminals. The Palestinian people refuse to disappear. They will resist and fight until they have overthrown the yoke of Zionist colonialism and achieved their freedom.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be talking about a topic which is very important, and it is a topic that has, you know, been discussed in various disciplines such as fiqh, jurisprudence, akhlaq, ethics, and even like other topics like irfan and these kind of topics. That topic is concerned in general with backbiting. Backbiting is, it's one of the major sins, one of the kaba'ir, as they call them. It's a very grave sin. If we categorize sins, we can categorize sins in different categories. They say that backbiting falls under the category of sins which are performed with the tongue. Like, for example, slandering, lying, backbiting, these are all sins related to the tongue. This is a grave sin that the Quran has scorned and scolded and prohibited us from performing. In one verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and do not backbite about one another. Would any of you love to eat the flesh of his dead brother? You would hate it. And be wary of Allah. Indeed, Allah is all clement, all merciful. In fact, the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, alluding to the intensity of the reprehensibility of backbiting, he once said, backbiting is worse than adultery. At which he was asked, how so? He replied, a man commits adultery, then repents, and Allah pardons him for it. Whereas the backbiter is not forgiven until his victim forgives him. So, this is allusion to the fact that backbiting, when we backbite somebody, we're trampling upon another person's rights. Some sins, when we perform them, when we commit them, we are trampling upon, the rights of God. And, God can forgive us for them, He can forsake His rights. But in the case where we perform certain sins, we are trampling and infringing upon the rights of others, such as backbiting, in the case of backbiting. So in the case of backbiting, the person upon whom's rights we have infringed, he has to forgive us for them. And, this can be very complicated in the hereafter. Until that person does so, Allah won't forgive us. Now, the question we want to ask today is this. What happens if somebody is backbiting another person? What if I don't backbite a person, but I'm there and I'm listening to it, and I don't stop it? I don't stop the person from doing so. Would I have sinned if this happens or not? The answer to the question is yes, indeed. Listening to backbiting and not preventing it from happening is in fact a grave sin as well. In fact, in some hadiths, Imam Ali alayhi salam has been reported as having said, the one who listens to backbiting is as bad as the backbiter himself. And he also, Imam Ali alayhi salam once saw a man backbiting someone in the presence of his son, Al-Hasan, to whom he said, O my son, steer your hearing clear of such a person, meaning perhaps get up and leave that, the gathering where the person is backbiting someone else. For verily he took the most repulsive thing from his mind and poured it into yours. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at listening to backbiting and whether it is a sin or not in the light of the Quran and the Hadith. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT-5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.